All right, I'm with Wayne for the slightly delayed weekend pod. We're going to review United 1, Burnley 1, talk a little bit about Premier League funding rules and changes that may be coming, and a little bit about an article in The Telegraph today talking about Manchester United's summer transfer strategy. But before all that, Wayne, how are you doing? I hear you've been back and forth between the UK and Ireland for the past week or so.
Very energetic, very time-consuming, if I look beleaguered. If I look beleaguered, put it down to the travel and not the fact that I've watched Manchester United in another fine display of Premier League football. Another entertaining display, as Erik ten Hag puts it.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, what's more entertaining, a pint of Guinness and Temple Bar or Manchester United for 90 minutes? So I kind of thought after the end of the Burnley game, and we've had a couple of days to step back and digest it, that I can't wait for the season to end at this point. I normally live, breathe, eat, sleep football, like I suspect most of the people listening to this and you as well. And I mean, of course, we've got the cup final to come and that really matters, but the rest of it doesn't so much. I mean, it's going to be the difference between Europa League, Europa Conference League, or maybe not being in Europe at all. And I suppose that means something for the financials.
Yeah,
it's hard getting yourself up for that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I will say that we've been here so many times. The second half of Manchester United season has disintegrated into this pursuit of wanting it to end. Too many times over the last few years, the last decade or so, the first time under Moyes, you thought, all right, well, this is different. You know what I mean? Like, you've got to brace yourself for something different. We knew that.
Yeah,
it wasn't likely to be as successful as under Ferguson. And I get that some people are invested in the idea of chasing for a top four finish. I think the United standard as a club, what is that's beneath them. And I think top four is maybe because it might be an age thing as well, that, like, you know, we are of an age when they brought in second place qualification for the Champions League and then third place and fourth place, and then Arsenal were mocked for a decade, or well, maybe half a decade, or when they moved to the Emirates, and it was kind of like, oh, they've got to keep qualifying for the Champions League. And United have kind of been dragged into that trap by the virtue of the debt that's been on them and servicing the debt and being able to operate in the transfer window and things like that over the last few years. And, you know, how pivotal has been to the swings and roundabouts of whatever manager was there at the time. There's always been some kind of invested interest in that. But from a supporter's perspective, in the investment of it being actually interesting, you're probably going to find it a little bit weird that I'm coming out with something like this, considering my general stance on supporting managers and progress and everything like that. But I do have this feeling that first is first and second is nowhere. So, all right, from the perspective of wanting United to kick on to the next level and be able to attract better calibre of players and obviously wanting better for the club, yes, I want Champions League football, but my interest in it, like this season for example and next season, my interest in seeing United participate in the Champions League was not because I wanted, because I thought that without any chance of winning it, because really when we've seen it, we've been embarrassed in the Champions League. So you don't want to see your club embarrassed. Nobody wants to see that. And I get the idea of like finishing there and you want to compete on the highest level, but we're not ready for that. We don't have a club ready for that. We don't have a team ready for that. So all these kind of things, really, again, one of my traditional long-winded answers, I don't really have that much investment. If we're not in a title race, and we haven't been for 10 years, even the ones where we've finished second twice, we've not been in a title race. It does give me somewhat of a better objective stance to then go stand back and say, well, United have finished second a couple of times. They weren't in the title race. And that gives you a greater objectivity on rating the rest of the second place teams, because if you can hand on heart say that we were nowhere near it, and we, this generation of United team, it'd be laughable to say that they're better than this generation of Liverpool team, but they are finished above them twice. It gives you a lot of an indication about the strength or weakness, as it may be, in the league. And I just can't, all right, the cup final is something to get up for sure, but the cycle that I find myself stuck in is, especially the last 4 years, that I've seen enough and I want to see big change. And sometimes we've seen that, like as much as is reasonable with a manager in one window, a couple of them have made a lot of, I think Ollie did in his first summer, he made a lot of swinging changes And then Ten Hag did in his first summer, he made a lot of changes.
Yeah.
I know we're going to talk about Burnley, and then you start asking how they're learning the lessons, and the manager isn't. And then you look at it and you think, what is there to be excited about?
Yeah, no, I get it. Actually, Big Ange, sorry to interrupt, but I was just thinking as you were talking about it, Ange Postecoglou gave an answer, which was kind of similar in a press conference a couple of weeks ago when he was pressed on qualifying for the Champions League. And the journalist, who I forget who it was now, kept going on about this kind of financial aspect of qualifying for the Champions League. And to paraphrase, he was like, who cares, right? Does that mean we're going to do better next season? Does that mean it's going to be better football? Does that mean it's taking the club forward? And he kind of had a big picture, more holistic view of like where they were in their journey. And I kind of think that's what you're saying as well, isn't it? You know, we've got a journey we need to go on. And I think now with the Ineos team in place and some of the strategy seemingly coming out, and we'll talk about that in a bit, that there is a kind of end goal in place, and they're trying to put the things in place that allow United to successfully get to that end goal. And that end goal has been really clearly articulated, and that's returning Manchester United to its perch or to preeminence in England and Europe and being competitive again. And they're thinking with that end goal in place rather than what has basically been, what, four different short-term resets since Ferguson retired, or five, I guess. And none of that has ever worked. And so the change in strategy now is not, hey, a bunch of new players and new manager. It's, okay, have we got the right structure in place to allow whatever players and whatever managers currently in Manchester United to have their best chance of succeeding? And if qualifying for the Champions League helps that, then great. If it doesn't, I mean, like, for example, if we had a very young squad, which we don't really, but if we did have, if after this summer we end up with a very young squad, might actually be better for their development to be in the Europa. They're going to get more game time. They're not as likely to get embarrassed by the best teams in Europe.
Yeah.
Even if the financial aspects of it aren't quite as good in the short term, maybe the development path is better, as we've kind of seen with Arsenal, haven't we? They may or may not win the league this season, but they're going to be close. And they trusted in a complete change in strategy, which was a young player-focused strategy and a young manager. Even if he has got a ridiculous haircut and his trousers are way too tight. Just wrong. It's just wrong. So even if they've got those really important things like haircut and clothing wrong, they seem to have got the club development strategy right. And I think that's what we're thinking about now, isn't it?
Maybe. But to just jump on that, because I do think that we won't know with Arsenal for another couple of years. It looks promising now, but then it looked promising in Liverpool, and everyone can give Klopp his plaudits. And I happen to believe that in terms of being a great manager, he's probably been better than Pep over this period of time. I think I look at what Klopp's achieved at the side of Pep, and I think,
right,
Liverpool's a more laudable achievement. But what I'm saying with the overall perspective is that they were still best of the rest. And Arsenal, they might well win the league this season. I hope that they do. See, sentence I never thought I'd say. But even if they do, you're still looking at the next two or three years, because then maybe they will kick on. Maybe, you know, the Declan Rice and Odegaard combination and that kind of Saka being as brilliant as he is. Maybe that is a basis to build upon. Or maybe City will buy Saka off them and that kind of thing. Like, you're getting too close for comfort. We'll steal your best player, that kind of thing. And Arsenal, for all their money and for all the solidity at the moment, they are still susceptible to that kind of thing. And
of course,
so that's one thing. That's one thing. I look at them and, oh, they're still going to be second best of the Arsenal rounds. And that's been a generational interest for me, because I look at United have never been close to that, never been close to being that second best of the Arsenal rounds, even when they've been second best. So you look at that and you look at fans of Liverpool, you look at fans of Arsenal, and the way that they sort of hype up their team's achievements in light of finishing second best and saying, oh, this is the best Liverpool team of all time. And now you've seen a few big Liverpool accounts saying, oh, Salah, the best player ever. Don't be silly. It's Gerrard or Dalglish. They're backing down quickly because they know that cycle's coming to an end. And there's a greater generation of success that happened a little while ago. Arsenal are currently caught in that flux. You don't know where it's going to end with those. United, there's no Emperor's new clothes with United, you know how bad they are. You know how bad they are for a decade. You're not under any false illusions about where they were and saying that they were better than what they were. We all know that it's been a poor decade, so we know how far we need to go with that. And my point overall is that these clubs can get sucked into thinking things are better than what they are for those clubs when they're in competition with City, because to say that you're in competition with them at the moment is to dine at that table. I can't see it that way, because I think United have got, they've always got to stand on their own 2 feet. They've got to be judged on what they do themselves, and they have always been judged on what they do themselves. And being where they are, particularly since, this entire season has been a write-off since September when we've got the injuries and the performances were terrible. You already knew it was a massive backwards step. So it wasn't a case of, we'll definitely qualify for the Champions League and let's see how we kick on. It was kind of like, we probably are not going to qualify for the Champions League this year. So there's a much bigger, like you were alluding to earlier, there's a much bigger picture at play here. And I think, I know we're going to talk about Burnley, but it brings us on to that. All of these micro decisions about Ten Hag now, it's away from the injuries. We know that the injuries are one thing. Some will give him a pass for that. Some will give it a caveat. Some will say it's not good enough, even with the injuries. So then you're judging Ten Hag on everything else that he does, and are you still seeing progress? Regardless, just to finish the point on that, reasonably speaking, logically speaking, whether it was a Glazer family or Ratcliffe in charge of the decision, if he doesn't qualify for the Champions League, he's probably going to lose his job. But for the rest of us who monitor progress as something that you see with your eyes, are we progressing as a football club? That's irrelevant of what City are doing. It's almost irrelevant of what everyone else in the league is doing, because we know that the demands on United are to be number one, and it's about how far away we are from that. And so it doesn't matter. So just to finish on that, and I'm really sorry for going on, but the point is about the Champions League and the Europa League and all that sort of stuff, is that it barely even matters, especially once you get into the December catastrophe performances like Copenhagen and Galatasaray and Bournemouth, because the problem's so severe that it needs that longer fix. So you're not even thinking about things like Champions League, because it's laughable to think about it at that point.
Well, Wayne, you normally speak between 3,000 and 5,000 words per episode, and that's a fraction of the number of words that are in one of your books. So it's quite tight. No, I mean, to round off this section, and we'll actually talk about Burnley. I actually think, and you'll never catch me saying this on a recorded ever, so people can come back to me, but I think Klopp has been a far better manager than Pep in terms of the value add. And he's going to end his time at Liverpool with one Premier League title in 9 years and, a couple of Carling Cups in the Champions League, in which he beat Tottenham Hotspur. Yeah, lads, it's Tottenham. Doesn't really count as a Champions League, does it? And an asterisk on the one title because it came in the COVID season. So from that perspective, it's an underachievement. But he, aside from a couple of freak seasons, which Klopp has done throughout his career, all his teams burn out and have an off season. He has kept Liverpool extremely competitive. So you won't catch me singing his praises again. That'll be it, folks. All right, Klopp. And part of the reason, of course, people don't need me to say this, is because you've got a state-funded club that have cheated their way to success. No one can compete with them anymore.
Yeah.
All right, Burnley. Latest in a long line of deeply frustrating games and partially incompetent performances. But you know what? It actually started out all right. That first 25 minutes or so, I was like, oh, are we seeing a competent Manchester United performance? Were they in control for 20 minutes or so? Did my eyes deceive me when I was watching this going, they actually seem to be bossing this. What's going on? Yeah. No. Manchester United, like, no, we can't be having this. We're going to punch you in the dick if you think, not literally, metaphorically, if you think we're becoming a real side. No. But I suppose it was entertaining, as Eric liked to tell us afterwards.
Yeah. I think you have definitely been too optimistic if you think the 25 minutes were good. But I see where you're coming from in terms of control. But then you look at the fact that it was Burnley and the
19th in the table. Yep.
Yeah, the three teams that are going to go down this season are probably three of the worst teams we've ever had in Premier League history in a bad league. And United, as they too often do, play down to the level of the opposition. They did play with some control in that first period, which classic United disintegrated over the period of time. I think it's now 9 games from 11 where a goal has been conceded in the last 5 minutes.
Wow.
I think 3 of those games, the result has changed twice in the last 10 minutes. So I'm thinking Chelsea,
right,
Brentford, and again, against Burnley at the weekend. Burnley were bad. Burnley were really poor. That's a really poor Burnley side. They have come up with this guy as a playing possession football, pretty football, which is funny, really, to think about Burnley. Historically, they've always been sort of Sam Allardyce team. And fair play to them for sticking with that, even in the reality of swift demotion back to the league. But back to the lower league. But as the game went on, they did look to have more control. They were creating some of those openings. And if you look at quality of chances, I know there's XG and all that, and United had more chances. But on quality of chances, I think they'll be disappointed they didn't win that. They forced an honour into 2 very, very good saves.
Yeah. One of them from the header from, Aboga? I can't remember who did the header from Burnley, but probably his best save of the season, right? With his left hand stepping away and then stepping back to save. Yeah, top save, that one.
One of those as well that you, when you look at a lot of Onana's saves, you think even the penalty save and the shootout, it looked like he was making a mess of it because it against Coventry. It looks like he palms it from one hand to the other. So a lot of his good saves, you think are generally caused by him being off a second late to the reaction. So it looks a bit staged on them. You know when they say save for the cameras? That's what a lot of his good, better ones look like, even if they're not. But this one was a genuine top-class reflex save that, honestly, I didn't think he was capable of doing. So we were kept in the game by that. The goal came out of nowhere. Antony's goal came out of nowhere. But even when he scored, and this is the most damning indictment I could say of anything that's been at Old Trafford this season, especially considering we're playing Burnley at home. As soon as Antony scored, I think that there was a collective sort of anticipation of, oh God, what happens next? Honestly, I do believe that. I think like there was a feeling of something's going to happen. And it was kind of when they got the penalty, it was almost like, obviously, people were laughing, you know, like not in terms of like the absurdity of the time it took to make the decision, everything like that. It was just like, obviously this was going to happen. And it happened. And United didn't deserve more than the point that they got from the game. And I guess I know you want to come in and talk about your perspective. There was just one more point I want to make on the overall passage of the game, and it's the first substitutes that he made, the ones Hoyland and Maynou, when they came off.
Maynou,
which were, considering we weren't playing it again for another 9 days, is quite very, very unbelievable decisions, really. I mean, I could almost have accepted if he had started without Garnacho, because he's played so many games. So like maybe play Diallo from the left or play Antony from the left, even put Diallo on the right, give him the chance to run. But and we've talked before on this podcast about the first 9 months, almost to a T, how every single decision Ten Hag made, he might not have all yielded a positive result, but you understood why he was making it. And even
they
more than
come
that,
off, didn't they?
Yeah. And even more than that, they'd make some that would surprise us sometimes. And especially in that first 4 or 5 months, it makes some that you were, oh, I wasn't expecting that to happen. And then he did it, and it came off in an unexpected way. And then you're praising his prescience then. You're saying, all right, he's got his finger on the pulse of this team. He understands what this team need more than what we need, than what we do as a supporter. But I think looking in from the weekend, and you saw the changes that he made, they were the changes of a manager under pressure, bringing McTominay on. They weren't the decisions of a man reading the flow of the game and thinking, United need to get more control in this, they need to be more proactive, they need to stop behaving like a Manchester United side. It was the thing of what has got me results in the past season is sticking McTominay on. And that's not conducive to a future Manchester United team. And really, he paid the price for making bad substitutions. It really, really rubbed the crowd up the wrong way. And
it did.
By the way, it's a crowd still fairly in support of Ten Hag. They're not getting on Ten Hag's back just yet, I don't think. But they are getting on the back of some of the decisions, because that one was bewildering. Yeah. It really was bewildering, that one.
It was very odd. And if you'd said it was a sports science decision and they've had too many minutes and they're tired and all of that kind of stuff, you go, okay, fine. But as you say, it's a long time until the next game. But also, United have had just a ridiculous amount of muscle, soft tissue and muscle injuries this season, not impact injuries. And it's the kind of thing that points to overtraining. Now, I don't know that. It's pure speculation, just making that up. But it looks like there's a very heavy load on them, and that's why they've got all these muscle injuries, and it doesn't seem to have been something that Ten Hag has been concerned about until recently. And as you say, at the same time as taking Højlund and Maynou off and saying afterwards they needed it, you don't know, which we don't. We don't have the same data that they have. Garnacho started the 49th game in a row, or whatever it is. It's not that many, is it?
But
it's not far off. So some of it does feel a bit inconsistent. But you're right. The changes kind of coincided with Burnley coming into the game and starting to get some control in the game. They ended the game. I talked about United's first 20 minutes and having some kind of control. The game ended with Burnley having more possession than Manchester United. That's 19th placed Burnley at Old Trafford having more possession. And of course, the stat that matters most is the goals, but still, it's kind of pretty stark, isn't it? I mean, can you imagine any other like bottom three likely relegated club in any of the other top leagues going to one of the top teams and bossing them in that way? It seems preposterous, but we seem to have got ourselves in this position, and Ten Hag has got himself in this position that he goes, okay, this is the way we're going to play now. We're going to play with fast, direct transitional football. And direct, I mean, getting the ball forward quickly, not lumping it.
Yeah.
Although occasionally there is that as well. I mean, if you look at Onana's pass, Matt, for example, this is the guy we bought because he is effectively a sweeper, yet he's lumping it forward. And I'm quite sure that's not because he wants to lump it forward. And yeah, a lot of strange stuff. Substitutes were strange. Makeup of the team's pretty strange. Got Eriksen starting another game. He was dying on his ass. Well, by about an hour, and yet he stayed on. That was weird as well.
Can I make a couple of points on this? Sorry to jump in a bit. On the team selection is an interesting one, because I think, obviously, after the Coventry game, no matter how we deflected the criticism, he needed, I'm talking about Ten Hag, he really needed two massive performances. And I get that Sheffield United and Burnley at home are almost like a Newport away in the cup. You can't win even by winning, you can't win because you're going to get criticism. But United really needed something to pin their hopes on moving forward for the rest of the season.
Yeah.
And I think, so the best way to, well, I say the best way in hindsight, it felt like moving into those two games, you needed to shake it up. You needed to make a couple of bold changes from the start, so this can't go on. And I'm saying something like starting from Ari Amas at left back. Do you know what I mean? You've got balance. You've got a young kid there. Those lads have done well in the lower. You know, like start with some of those kids. Is it Wheatley who came on against Sheffield United? Start with him if you need to. Give Højlund a break from the start. Give Garnacho a break. Give Maynou a break. If you want to take them out of the side, do it on the start of a game that people will understand they need a rest. Put them on the bench. You know what I mean? Then you're sending a couple of messages there. You're protecting the kids. All right, we understand that. You're also being ruthless with some of the other players like Dalot, who needs time out from performance rather than fitness. So then you've got Amas there, and you're saying, all right, these are two games that United are expected to win. It might not go well from the start because those kids are putting a lot of pressure on them, but now is the time for those kids to get a chance. But then what you do have is you've got the capability to change it with the players, and then you can invoke a better atmosphere by bringing Maynou and Højlund and Garnacho on, then you can.
And then taking them off.
Sucking them off. Yeah, exactly. And then the other thing with that is the secondary point of it is that I said that point earlier about United having collapsed late on in 9 out of 11 games. I remember And I know the frame of reference is always the Ferguson era, but let's use it as a frame of reference for any top team who has their act together and is properly run as a squad.
Yeah.
You might see like a collapse, a poor run of form that might have taken three games, that Crest would be on the back of the Daily Mirror correcting off. It'd be crisis time at Old Trafford. Fergie would read the right acts. There'd be a major change in there, whether it's sticking Phil Neville in midfield. And eventually that team would get back to the 4-4-2 with all the personnel that you knew he would normally have at the start of the season. But he'd read the right act for a little bit. There'd be a change in there, people to up the game, and things would move on. Nothing is changing in any of these games. It's the same thing that's happening all the time. And I think that especially this, like, and I write, I get the idea that, you know, we've got injuries and everything like that. But like I've just explained there, there's a capability from within
that still
squad,
options.
Particularly, never more so than against Burnley and Sheffield United at home. And if you don't use it then, you're in big trouble if it starts to slip away. Yeah, and that's not worrying.
And it's when Ten Hag said afterwards, oh, we're one of the most entertaining teams in the league. And then you compare that to the data. Don't score much, letting a lot of goals. I mean, I know we've been scoring more recently, and maybe that's what he's talking about. But fighting it out for seventh place with Newcastle United, it doesn't resonate with what we're seeing with our eyes and how people in the stadium feel, and certainly quite loud jeers when Menu came off and Hoyland came off, loud jeers. And then a sort of cheer for Scott McTominay because he's popular for good reasons, I think. Yeah. But it's clear that Ten Hag's message is not resonating with supporters. I don't know if he's lost Old Trafford yet. It doesn't feel like it from the outside. Obviously, I wasn't there. You were, so you'll have a better insight on that. But it doesn't feel like he's completely lost the crowd yet. But he's not making a lot of sense. And I don't think... I'd much rather he goes, look, we've had all these injuries. It's not gone to plan. I'm trying a few different things because we're trying to... There's some square pegs in round holes. And it's not ideal, but this is what we're trying on. Why? Instead, he's sort of giving it the Chemical Alley thing, going, oh, there's nothing to see here. Actually, we're great. We've just played three championship quality sides in a row and been pretty shit in all three of those games.
And that's my worry, is that I agree. And from my awareness of it, I don't think there's any turning against him from the Old Trafford crowd. However, I do think that the events of the last week, 8 days, are difficult. They're very, very difficult to start making a case for him. And, I'm not here to start saying I can't see a way forward for him and tell that I think it's time to sack him. Obviously, it looks very difficult. And I just think that everything that, while losing the games, everything that could go wrong, the worst way to win all those, the worst way to get results from all of those games, I feel like we've done it over the last week.
Yeah.
That is definitely not what you needed. I think... Where you're not seeing a crowd against him, what you are seeing is a lot of people outside saying, what the F was that? You know what I mean? And I think that's two steps away, isn't it, from vocal discontent for the manager. And I hope not, because I hope that... But what you're going to see is you've got to see him understanding it. You've got to... He doesn't have to say it. He can say what he wants, and anyone can... pick the bones out of it, but you've got to start seeing it, unfortunately, and we are there now.
Well, all right, let's get to a few of the incidents in the game, because, I mean, some of it was fun, some of it was sort of controversial and stuff to debate. So Anthony's goal, what are talking about a what-the-fuck moment? What was the whole pre-planned Sonic the Hedgehog thing? I didn't quite understand it. I have to say, for a man who scored one goal this season... and has had two pretty underwhelming seasons. I may be being generous there, actually. You've got a hell of a lot of stones on you to go, hey, you know what? I might score. I know I haven't scored in the other 67 games this season, but I might score today, so I'm going to pre-plan something with the Sonic the Hedgehog thing. Didn't get it. Not sure what he was doing. Don't know that I was that impressed, really, although I found it quite amusing. Yeah. Little odd. What did you make of that? Fine goal, by the way. He actually beat his man.
For pace, yeah.
Rather than his girlfriend, which makes a change. Sorry, I shouldn't make that. I know. Comedians say there's a groan is as good as a laugh. It's not, is it? I saw the virtual groan on your face with that one. But it was a fine goal from him. No, it wasn't. Anthony. He's got some pace when he decides to run.
No, like his battle against Cucurella I talked about a few weeks ago. You know, it's a good goal. I do think, I've got nothing against the celebration, fine. Celebrate how you want to. I remember Tevez used to do the hygienic pull the dummy out of the shorts thing, which, you know, was quite concerning, but he did that nonetheless. I just think doing it when you know, when it's planned for an occasion, like I remember the Arsenal, the rumour, the myth that they had the 50 T-shirts on when they lost Old Trafford. I just think it's small time because in the respect that you're concentrating on yourself and not the bigger picture, you're concentrating only on what you're doing in that moment and all, you as a team or you as a player. And it just smacks of someone. And I know, look, don't get me wrong, I do happen to think that Anthony understands the privilege of playing for United. It seems to matter to him that he plays for a big club like United, where maybe it doesn't matter to many other people in the same kind of way. And I do appreciate that about him. And, you know, he obviously fights. We joke about his lack of pace, but the effort's there. And that was actually evident in the goal. You know, it showed perseverance and quality, and it meant something to him. But it's like, what it should have meant to him, really, is that sort of like outbreak of elation and relief that we all saw. But it's kind of like, look at me. Like the celebrations against Coventry, it's like, look at me, oh, I'm rubbing it in your face, it's all about me. And it's like, it's just, why? You've let yourself down in that moment. And the era, you can joke about the bigger picture stuff he's let himself down about. But that, when you don't need it, because especially that kind of thing, it's there to be used as a punchline against you. And he was. And
yeah,
you don't like, that's the kind of thing you don't want United reduced to, that kind of thing. Unfortunately, we are. Well, I mean, we have been for a while.
We're going to remember Anthony for his 720 degree spin, his stupid celebration against Coventry, who are giving me the big, and Sonic the Hedgehog thing, and less for his performances. And I mean, we'll have him next season because no one will buy him for a fee that makes any kind of sense. So maybe third season's a charm. I don't know. A couple of the other incidents, there was the shout for a potential handball. I mean, it was very close quarters and his hand was down by his side. But then so was Wan-Bissaka's when the penalty was given against him a couple of weeks back. So I don't buy into any kind of conspiracy theory. I do think humans make mistakes. VAR was supposed to correct some of that. But the deeply frustrating thing, I think, for all football fans of all clubs is the inconsistencies. And VAR hasn't evened those out. And especially with offsides and handballs. Yeah. Those are the two things that drive everyone up the wall. And handball, I can read the rule and the guidance. I can't tell you how it would be interpreted with any one incident. And it seems to me that the rest don't know how to interpret it consistently either.
I agree. It's difficult. The handball one is, like you say, you've got the Wan-Bissaka and then you've got the Foden one the day before. And that really, throughout the season, there's been an inconsistency of decisions. United have been involved in a lot of them, particularly with handballs. I agree with everything that you said. I think the handball is kind of like a grey area, offside.
I know. It should be very black and white, and it's not, is it? It seems to be that there's a continuum of handball offences. And the other one was Garnacho. In real time, I looked at it and thought, oh, he's gone down a bit easy there. But when you see it back again, his ankle is definitely clipped. I mean, I don't know what the definition of a foul is. If that's not a foul, that's a foul, isn't it? It's just his ankle was clipped.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. On the replay, to be fair, even on the replay, it looked, if we speak about the same incident, it looked like they were coming across each other. And so I look at that and it's not obvious to see, but the fact of the matter is that you have a player who's running at pace, and if he's not, and I know, all right, people are, but this is the point of a referee then, and the value of looking at replays, because then you can see a natural action and what's not a natural reaction. And his fall seemed fairly natural. It seemed reactive to the touch.
Yeah.
And so, I can't really disagree with what you're saying there. I mean, in terms of, like, I think sometimes referees might not give them. I can understand that. And I can understand why we got the penalty given against us and all that. So, all in all, I'm not really, it's not one of those things. I'm more inclined to point the finger at the players and saying, oh, for the result this weekend, I think some of those like go around. But they shouldn't, the point is that it shouldn't be swings and roundabouts with all these kind of decisions. There should be very clear.
If United are not beating Burnley at Old Trafford, it's got fuck all to do with a refereeing decision.
Exactly.
I mean, there's
yeah.
bigger problem. There's bigger problems than that. I mean, Onana, I mean, if you take a ball and then clean out the man in any part of the pitch, it should be a foul. Now, that is not consistently given in any part of the pitch.
No.
He did almost exactly the same thing against Wolves at the beginning of the season. There were those 4 days of national wailing that Wolves didn't get a penalty for it. So I suppose it should have come back and bit United at some point.
Yeah.
So maybe that's a foul. Thing is, Ederson did the same thing for City. You know, hit the ball, clattered the man.
Yeah.
Against Forest, wasn't given.
Exactly, yeah.
Which prompted Mark Goldbridge to start arguing with himself on Twitter, which was very odd. Some people suspect that he's got a burner account. I don't know. Couldn't possibly say which one was the burner, to be honest with Goldbridge, the main one, or the Forest one he was tweeting at himself with. But yeah, I don't know. It's not big picture, isn't it? Like, United didn't not beat Burnley because the referee gave one decision one way and one another, and like shouldn't matter, should it?
No, but I mean, technically to Ten Hag it does, doesn't it? You know, he's calling out those decisions. But again, I talk about the comments of a manager under pressure. You can always tell the difference. You can always see someone who's more comfortable with everything, and he does seem to be stressed about it. So I think taking away, we can all see that United aren't entertaining. They are on the dictionary definition of the word. Someone can watch a Manchester United match and be entertained. Of course they can, but not for the right reasons, obviously, if you're a Manchester United fan. And I think everybody knows that he knows that. I just don't know. He's a manager under pressure. He's speaking like a manager under pressure.
Very much.
I don't think anyone reasonable is not looking at the refereeing decisions of the weekend and saying, oh God, if we'd have got those, we'd have beat Burnley. We're all looking inwardly and saying there's a lot more than needed to be done.
Quite. I think, obviously we're all leading up to the cup final, aren't we, on May the 25th, so just under a month before that. Unfortunately for him, it looks really difficult now. I mean, it should, like, Brighton mid-table, not in great form, but regularly beat us. Newcastle coming into some form, that's a big one in terms of Europa/Conference League places, and there is a difference in money and prestige and status between these two things. And Palace actually in very good form at the moment, won 3 of their last 4, including scoring five on one occasion, so it doesn't look awesome for him. We could well head into that. Oh, and Arsenal, who are obviously going for the title, and I fully suspect we'll lose that one. So we could end up going into that cup final with another 2 or 3 defeats and some poor performances before the end of the season. I kind of suspect that's the most likely scenario, which isn't awesome, is it? We'd like a bit of momentum, but it's hard to see how that's going to happen.
I agree. Well, it's not catastrophizing just yet. It's not happened just yet, right?
No. All right, let's move on from the football to fun stuff like finances. There's a piece. Well, it was just breaking as we started recording today. It'd been mooted for some time that new profit and sustainability rules would come in that looked like they're more in line with UEFA's squad cost rule. The Premier League have gone one step further and voted today to at least analyse the possibility of doing an anchoring strategy, which will mean they will. The maximum you could spend is some kind of multiple of the lowest earning Premier League club, and likely they'd anchor to broadcast revenues rather than overall revenues. What does this mean? It's quite bad for United, but I think good for sustainability. So probably the first time in the 20-odd years of the Premier League that the league has voted not to concentrate more wealth with the biggest clubs, and in fact actually look at doing something that looks more equitable.
Yeah.
So based on this season, just over 100 million, the bottom club will earn from broadcast revenues, which would make the cap at something like 500 million or 450, depending on what the final multiple is, something like that. United voted against it. City voted against it. You can understand why. We both have massive commercial revenues. In United's case, genuine. In City's case, it all comes from Abu Dhabi. And obviously, if that's not taken into account, it has a relatively larger impact on United and City than everyone else. I'm surprised Liverpool voted for it, actually, because they do have big commercial revenues. And so do Spurs now with a new stadium, and they voted for it. And then Villa, who don't, voted against with City and United. Yeah. Little oddball. I'm not quite sure what the thinking is there. And then Chelsea abstained, which is very odd altogether. I don't know what that's for. But anyway, it goes to a full deliberation and analysis before they actually ratify any of this. Thoughts?
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's a bit of a left field one, isn't it, really? Because everyone's talking about FFP and the charges and that kind of traditional format of profit and sustainability for clubs. So I'd be interested to see how it actually works in action. I think United, and I am surprised that United have voted against, and maybe that may have something to do with Ratcliffe's ownership ideals. But I do recall that traditionally, even under the Glazers, anything that's sort of the status quo, United have generally supported that. They've never been one to sort of deviate. You know, like if they wanted to in the earlier days of the Premier League, whenever the television rights have been renegotiated, whenever there's been those conversations about fair play across the board, they could have easily said, no, we're going to start branching out like Barcelona and Real Madrid and start trying to negotiate our own rights. And you know what I mean? If they really wanted to flex the muscles, they could have done that. But they've always been...
Well, Super League would have done that, but...
Yeah. No, exactly. And, yeah. And to be fair, obviously they did explore that and they were going down that route. But in terms of the domestic pyramid, they've always kind of been conscientious with that. I think that's one of the things I like. I've always liked about United is that they have done that despite the size and despite the power. So this seems against that. So it's interesting to see the logic. We don't really know anything about it apart from the news that's broken today. So I'd like to see if there's some explanation from Ratcliffe. It's been quite open with dialogue, and I guess if someone interviews
him, we'll see. Yeah.
And talks about
I'm sure it's to do with the fact that the anchoring is going to be anchored on broadcast revenue rather than overall revenue. And I'm sure that's why United voted against it, because what it would do is leave a lot of headroom. So if you're going to do that, I mean, obviously UEFA has a slightly different rule, but imagine it's a squad cost plus this anchoring would mean that if United start being successful again and start increasing their commercial revenues, it wouldn't make any difference how much they could spend.
Yeah.
And so you'd have a lot of free cash flow just sitting around, which would be great for the Glazers if they could take money out, which they can't now because of the structure of the Ratcliffe partial takeover. And so you could end up having a club with a very high amount of EBITDA. They can't spend it on the squad under these rules. So I don't know. What are they going to do? Are they going to cut prices at Old Trafford? Maybe. We'll see. Not been ratified yet, but it's interesting, I think. And there's plenty of room for the Premier League to do that. Premier League already spends about £2 billion a year more on transfers and wages, so squad costs, than the next highest spending league. So you can eat into the Premier League spending without eating into competitiveness. Yeah. And it may well, or it should have the effect of damping down spiraling wage inflation, which is bonkers, really. So you've got a situation where a whole bunch of clubs are putting up prices, including at United, and putting up prices for groups of people who may be more vulnerable or who can't afford it, like at Spurs, where they've started charging OAPs quite a significant amount more. And yet the league makes more money than anyone else, right? How does this make that make sense? And it's all because every penny generated is going into wages. Now, of course, the PFA have come out against this. Surprise, surprise. They don't want any cap on wages. This is not an actual wage cap. It's a spending cap, but it has the effect of reducing wages.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think there's obviously an economic climate to consider as well. I think like post-COVID, clubs were scared to pull the trigger on rising prices and stuff like that, but they've, like a couple of them, started to do it and bore the brunt of the criticism. Now the rest feel like it's fair game to follow because everyone else has done it. But no one's read the room in terms of how destitute the country still is, still trying to pick itself up.
Yeah, yeah.
Proud leader Joe Public is still trying to do that. And yeah, I mean, it's the way of everything, isn't it, really? We could talk about it's a completely different conversation to football, but I think it is bad taste when football of all the industries can afford to take the hit. It wasn't hurt really by the pandemic. Clubs have not sort of folded. Not many top flight clubs really suffered. They did suffer in the short term, don't get me wrong, but I mean, in comparison with each other, they're all brothers in arms, that the sport suffered, and now it's recovered. The country's economy hasn't recovered. The people haven't recovered financially. And I think it's a bit rich to be hitting them in the pocket with the rises, but we pay it because we keep going. So.
But they do it because it's an arms race and they're all competing with each other. I mean, the funny thing is with the Premier League, when COVID hit and every club around Europe really suffered the financial consequences of that, both in not selling tickets, but also broadcasters reclaiming money, the Premier League went out and continued spending. And I think there was a kind of collective decision made to go and ram home the advantage versus other leagues. And we see the consequence of that where some clubs spent too much. Forest and Everton, for all their complaining, broke the rules and admitted that they broke the rules. And it's because the clubs were going, okay, yeah, we've lost money, but we're going to keep on spending. This will definitely put a lid on that. It puts a hard cap, basically. We'll all know at the beginning of the season effectively how much you can spend, and the clubs that manage that spend the best will be the ones that are likely to be more successful if it gets voted through. So, all right, aligned to that, and it is quite aligned to it, is a summer transfer strategy piece by Ducker in the Telegraph today. I don't know whether you got a chance to read it. I'm not a subscriber, but I've heard rumours that there are sites out there that will allow you to remove the paywall and read the report. I wouldn't do that. That would be totally illegal, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, the piece says that United are basically open to offers for all of the players except for Garnacho, Mainoo and Hoyland, and that they would consider offers for absolutely anybody else, which is, I don't know if that's a departure or that's always the case with football because everyone's got a price, but there's that. And I mean, aligned to the money, there are going to be a ton of players leaving this summer, I suspect. Not least because quite a few are on free transfers and a few they would be happy to let go.
Yeah, I feel like United's big worry is you might even go back all the way to 2009 with the sale of Ronaldo in the glory days of United run before you were forced to bring on people like me. The first episodes talking about the great transfer of Michael Owen and stuff like that.
But the point
The point is, where did all the Ronaldo money go? And now, really, you can have that same conversation because the idea was, oh, well, we'll save half a million a week in wages, but we saved that money and United are still operating within this tight frame. Oh, no, we know the reasons why, don't get me wrong. We know the debt and everything like that. There's still as this noose in control over many facets of the club and still sort of fighting our way out of that. But the point was, you know, that you could hypothesize about, oh, well, you could release that equity and then suddenly you've got room to bring in another player, but that never happened with United. So now you look at the potential outgoings. On this occasion, I'm not really that bothered because I think so many people have sort of seen every cycle of this squad with all the players that it doesn't matter in which guys they move on, because talking about competitiveness is a different thing now as far as United are concerned. It is a massive reset button, and United's supporters have grown so tired of the players. It's almost a case like it's been re-energizing when it's been kids who've come in and replaced them. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying, oh, well, get them all out and put the kids in. But what I'm saying is there's been that level of frustration that's there that's so great that when a kid has come in and played, like me and like
it's a relief,
show,
isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And probably for the players who've gone out as well. So it is a weird thing, but still, in order to be competitive, those senior players who are going out will have to be replaced with quality. And don't get me wrong, there needs to be significant change. And if I don't think Ten Hag's not ruthless with that, I think if he's given the requisite funds to replace players, I think that that's what will happen. If he's the man in charge to do it, don't get me wrong. As it probably from a squad rebuilding perspective, the worst thing that United could do is change managers, regardless of the direction. It's the length of the time that it takes to A, find a new manager, B, agree a compensation deal to get rid of this one, C, then touch that manager about the targets that he wants, D, look at where that aligns with the
current... They might be doing that right now.
They might be, but then he's still going to come in and look at the current squad. There'll be players that you don't like or I don't think have got a chance and think that they're going to get another chance. Like I think someone was saying earlier when they were doing an hypothetical squad drop, oh, like Sancho could get another chance. Why? Really, the time is now to move him on. And even if Ten Hag goes, you're still saying that player's got the capability to be bigger than the manager if you keep him in that dressing room. Unfortunately,
yeah.
That's what you're doing with managers. So,
I was looking at all the contracts, and it's kind of interesting because Varane, Eriksen, Heaton, Martial, Evans, and Williams are all out of contract. Donny van de Beek, I was a bit unsure about. It's a bit unclear. I think there may be an option there, but they've also agreed. They've agreed a fee with Eintracht Frankfurt, who've only played him 8 times this season. So I don't think they're going to be taking up that option somehow. And Maguire, McTominay, Lindelof, Aaron Wan-Bissaka and Diallo are all into the last year of their contract after this summer. They all have one more year as an option on all of those. So there's an option to sell there, but they won't be at great fees, basically. And then obviously Sancho and Greenwood are toxic for different reasons. And I think everyone would be delighted if they can get any kind of fee for those two. And then off the rest, like most of the rest, they're very difficult to sell. Rashford's not going to go anywhere. He's on a mega contract. They'd want a really big fee for all the talk. He's the one who always gets the headlines, and he was the headline in the Telegraph today. I would be astonished. I'd be less surprised if Mourinho came back to United than I would be if United sold Rashford. And it's partly about United selling him and partly about who do you find as a buyer, given the total package and the uncertainty around him. I just think it's impossible. And then of the rest, I mean, who would they be selling? A few kids will leave. Fine. There won't be great fees for any of those. Shaw is perma-injured. No one would pay a high fee for him because it's just too, as good as he is when he's fit, like you couldn't rely on it. So that would reduce the fee. Malacia been out for a year. Apparently, he's going to come back all right. There's no long-term effects, but he had one operation on his knee and had a second one because it didn't go well. Like, Casemiro's on absolutely massive wages. They would have to give him away for free to get him off the books, and they may well look to do that anyway because he's got another 2 years on his contract. I don't see, like, it's a very long way of saying there's not a lot of flexibility to play with the strategy here. And it's unclear what the budget will be, but obviously it's going to be bigger if United are in the Champions League, which is not going to happen now. And even with the reduction in wages, I don't think it's awesome. There is the COVID season falling off. So after June the 1st, we move into another cycle. I actually think that, don't have all the numbers in front of me, but I think that is better for United. So don't know what the big number is on the transfers, but I don't think it's going to be massive. And I guess what I'm saying here is I don't see loads of huge fees coming for all these players that are available.
Now, I go back to Zidane, Iqbal went for like 2 million or something like that, low fee. So, and those are the kids are the ones with the 100% profit. The book value would be better for them to move on. And United have never, I spoke about this earlier in the season, is a good thing, that it's a reward for the players. But it's not a good position for United to be in at the moment.
They'll sell Alvaro Fernandez, 6 million to Benfica. Seems like that will do. Hannibal, I don't think there's a 20 million euro option on him. That's not going to be taken up. He's not played very much. So they'll get some money for these players if they want to move them on, but not loads.
Mm.
Like the big ones, if they were going to sell, should be Sancho and Greenwood, right? But they're toxic, so they won't be. Like there's not a chance in. Like, not a chance United are going to be able to sell Greenwood for the kind of fee he would have got prior to everything that happened. And at that point, they wouldn't have considered selling him because he's an academy player. So,
all right, you can look at the chain of events with him and say that they were regrettable with certain individuals making choices with him. But really, that's his fault. That's his fault. And yeah, all right, United have suffered as a result of that. Both through an age, and the fee, potential fee that they stand to get. I look at him as kind of like a inconsequential pot, or you know what I mean. It's terrible. It's all terrible. If United get anything for him at this moment in time, I guess that's a bonus in terms of thing. Like Sancho's a different kettle of fish. Like he's really the same boat as Hannibal. You know, like a great prospect at one point. Easy to forget that Hannibal started the season. You thought he was going to be in contention. Maybe Kobbie's injury hurt him earlier on, because if Kobbie had been in playing him alongside Annibal, when Annibal had that kind of momentum and he scored the goal against Brighton, maybe having those two around each other in midfield might have kicked each other on, really.
Yeah, maybe.
But it hasn't, you know, and his form sort of went, and his sort of value is not really going to be anywhere near as high, like you said. And like I said, with Sancho, his numbers are the same as Antony's. Do you know what I mean? Someone was putting him up earlier as that. So that's
three goals and two assists.
Yeah. They said, oh, well, that's what United are missing. It was like, well, no, they've got that. And it's not really good evidence of anything on that right-hand side looking any good at the moment. Even if you put all those numbers together from whatever Greenwood's got, whatever Sancho's got, and whatever Antony's got, you'd still want a little bit bit more on top of that to be a good right-hand-sided United player. So you don't know how much they're going to get for any of it.
Fine goal, though. Sancho's goal at the weekend.
Sancho's goal. I've not seen his goal. So you talk about Antony's again.
Oh, it's kind of half cleared, and then he does a nice first-time control, cuts inside and bends one into the top corner. So it's a very good goal.
Good,
and a kind of reminder of what he is capable of. It's just he doesn't deploy it very often. I was just looking at Hannibal's stats while you were talking. 4 games he's played. That one worked out then. I don't think we should be banking on the 20 million just yet.
No.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and Greenwood hasn't scored a lot of goals. He's got a couple of fine ones I think he's got 6 or something like that, which feels low, but he has been playing on the right-hand side of a 4-4-2, which is, there's some context to the numbers not being super impressive in a not particularly good side. So anyway, I don't know. I think that's enough of that nonsense, and probably enough for the midweek pod or weekend pod. Sorry, Monday recording of the weekend pod. Thank you very much, Wayne. Good to see you again. Enjoy your trip back to Dublin. Have a couple of pints of Guinness.
I think I might.
All right. Bye now.